ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. It's Friday, the 19th of April. I'm Sally Sara, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. And a warning that this next story contains distressing content. It's hard to fathom the tragedy of a 10-year-old boy's suicide in Western Australia. The boy, who cannot be named for legal reasons, was under the care of the Department of Communities and was being looked after by relatives when he died on Saturday. His death has raised concerns about the capabilities of the child protection system responsible for his well-being. Surging numbers of children have been taken into care over the past two decades in Western Australia. Rebecca Trigger reports.
A 10-year-old Indigenous boy took his own life in state care, and the pain from his death is hard to comprehend. National Suicide Prevention and Trauma Recovery Project Director Megan Cracker was with the family when they visited the state mortuary.
And I remember Dad coming out of the room, and he was just had tears. He was angry. There was just so much emotion, and he cried, and he fell to the ground. Shortly thereafter, Mum came out, and she was so many tears, and the pain, you could feel the pain coming from her to you, a precious little innocent soul.
The boy is understood to have taken his own life on Saturday night while living with a relative after being removed from his parents by the Department of Communities. Megan Cracker says the parents had not seen him for 8 months. National Children's Commissioner Anne Hollands says the child's death is an unspeakable tragedy, which was preventable.
You know, my heart's just broken for all of the family and the community that care about this child. It's horrific.
She says it's partly a consequence of overstretched child protection systems.
Well, we've known for some time now that the child protection systems around Australia are overwhelmed.
The number of children in care in WA's Department of Communities has more than doubled in the last 20 years, from just under 2,000 in 2004 to 5,170 late last year. Analysis shows a growing proportion of these children are Indigenous, reaching almost 60% last year, compared to just under 35% in 2004. Commissioner Anne Hollands says there's a need for urgent reform.
It's such a wake-up call for us as a society that we have failed this and so many other children.
Ms Hollands says the focus also needs to be on social services, health and education that can help families sooner before children have to be taken into care. Suicide prevention advocate Megan Cracker believes this tragic death is the youngest recorded suicide in the care of child protection authorities.
He was placed in care to be looked after, nurtured, and eventually come home to Mum and Dad. That never happened. He came home to them in a box.
Former Child Protection Minister in the Barnett government, Robin McSweeney, says there are important questions to answer.
If it's true that he didn't have any contact with his people for 8 months, then something in that department is very wrong. Now, is it that they don't have enough social workers?
In a statement, the Department of Communities said it couldn't comment on individual cases. But the Minister for Child Protection, Sabine Winton, says Labor has increased the number of full-time child protection workers by 30%.
That's Rebecca Trigger reporting. And if this story has caused you concern, you can call the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Crisis Support Line. That's 13YARN, that's 13 92 76. Or you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14. There are mounting allegations that Israel is engaging in systemic torture and abuse of Palestinians it detains in Gaza. Since the war began, Israel has detained thousands of Gazans under special national security laws, which allow questioning without charge and no access to a lawyer or judge for weeks. Some have reported being beaten, sleep-deprived, starved and sexually abused, and at least 27 have died in custody, as correspondent Lauren Day reports from Jerusalem. And a warning, this story contains some distressing details.
On a thin mattress in a tent in Rafah, with the constant drone of war above him, Mustafa Jamal Kalut feels lucky to be alive. He's still recovering from surgery for internal bleeding and broken ribs that he says were the result of relentless beatings inside an Israeli detention centre.
They did a surgery and opened my chest to suck the blood out. I spent 12 days in ICU.
He told the ABC he was blindfolded and taken out of Gaza in December, where he was subjected to beatings, sleep deprivation and sexual assault while being interrogated.
They would come with dogs on leashes and let them pee on us. There are things I feel ashamed to talk about. It was humiliating. They wanted to break our morale.
He was ultimately found to have no terrorism links and released. But Mustafa is not the only man at the refugee camp in Rafah with serious claims of abuse while in Israeli detention. 44-year-old Jibril El Khalout says he lost 30 kilos during his 60 days in detention.
There are traces of torture on my legs where they would tie us and do electric shock. Electric shocks were terrible and violent. Some of my teeth cracked due to torture.
It's hard to verify all of these claims, given Israel's secrecy around its detention regime, but they add to a disturbing number of similar stories from detainees who've been released from detention in Israel. And they've been backed up by doctors on both sides of the border. AM spoke to an Israeli doctor who worked briefly at the Sde Teman military base, the Israeli detention centre where most detainees from Gaza are taken, under special laws that allow them to be held and questioned without charge, access to a lawyer, or seeing a judge for weeks.
Every patient is restrained, every arm, each leg on the sides of the bed. At all times, they had eye coverage as well, and they were basically naked besides diapers.
So blind, bound, naked.
Exactly.
Some have likened the facility to Guantanamo Bay and called for it to be shut down immediately, a call echoed by the doctor who spoke to AM.
What I witnessed, I think, were obvious infractions of human rights and a system that perpetrates harm to these patients by limiting their access to proper medical care.
In a statement, the IDF said mistreatment of detainees is absolutely prohibited. They denied what they called unsubstantiated claims of sexual abuse and said the IDF acts in accordance with Israeli and international law. They also said any concrete complaints are forwarded to the relevant authorities for investigation. The United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture has launched an investigation into the allegations of mistreatment of Palestinian detainees in Israel. This is Lauren Day in Jerusalem reporting for AM.
It's been a slow start to day three of jury selection in Donald Trump's criminal trial in New York. Two jurors who'd been seated for the historic case were removed, but a total of 12 have now been found. North America correspondent Barbara Miller joined me a short time ago. Barbara, good morning. Talk us through the removal of the two jurors.
Well, one of the two was a woman and she'd contacted the court and said she was concerned that her anonymity had been compromised. So what happened after she was seated earlier in the week is that she started getting texts from friends and family saying, is that you? Are you the juror? Because certain biographical details about her, which were aired in court during the vetting process, had been published. So the judge agreed that she should be excused from the case because she had these concerns. Then the prosecution raised their concerns about another juror. They'd done research into him because, make no mistake, the prosecution and defense are raking over the lives of these people. They're looking at their social media posts. They're looking at their employers. They're trying to find anything that could suggest that they perhaps had a bias or that their credibility was in doubt. And they said that this man had not been entirely truthful in some of his answers. He was also removed. So it really seemed like the whole process was going backwards. They started the day with seven jurors, then they only had five. But really very quickly towards the end of the day, suddenly 12 jurors have been seated. A full jury has now been seated and the court is now trying to seat up to six alternates, people who will jump in case of, for example, illness on the part of one of the 12. So it began pretty sluggishly, but things starting to move pretty quickly in this historic case.
So, Barb, as you say, 12 jurors have now been found. When can we expect opening arguments in the case?
Well, it looks like they could start Monday next week. It's possible they'll sit all the alternates today, but I would think perhaps the judge needs tomorrow for any possible objections to those people, the kind of thing we saw happening with the two jurors today. It would seem surprising if opening arguments started on Friday. But Monday looks possible again, and you really get a sense from Judge Juan Merchan that he really wants to get this case moving. As you know, Donald Trump and his team have really tried to drag out this case, as well as the three other criminal cases he's facing. And the judge is really conscious that he needs to get this going, so wanting to move pretty quickly. Next week sees some potential difficulties. It's Passover, and the judge has agreed to make accommodations for anyone who's observing Passover, so it might be a shorter week. But we could see opening arguments in this case. And just as a reminder, this is the one where the prosecution argues that Donald Trump falsified business records, they say, to conceal a hush money payment to the porn actor Stormy Daniels. And that all happened during the 2016 presidential campaign.
That's North America correspondent Barbara Miller. Today, polling stations across India will open their doors, marking the beginning of the world's biggest election. South Asia correspondent Meghna Bali reports from Chennai.
The world's largest democracy is about to head to the polls.
Narendra Modi ji ko jai Shri Ram.
Around 12% of the world's population is eligible to vote in this election. That's almost a billion people. It's a mammoth exercise, run in seven phases over 6 weeks.
Bharat Mata ki.
In a few hours, the first phase will begin. More than 2,600 political parties are registered in this election. But according to analysts, the front runner is India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his Bharatiya Janata Party. They're seeking a rare third term after a decade in power. This is the Times of India's editor and political commentator, Arun Ram.
Across the country, BJP seems to be on a very strong wicket, especially the northern states. Another thing, I think, infrastructure-wise, the perception is that this government has done very well when it comes to roads, especially when it comes to infrastructure, transport, science and technology, space missions.
There are 543 seats up for grabs in the lower house, known as the Lok Sabha. To rule, a party or coalition need a simple majority of 272 seats. Mr. Modi and his allies are aiming for 400. To his supporters, Mr. Modi has increased India's standing on the global stage, grown the economy, and brought Hindu nationalism into the mainstream.
He wants to take the country forward, from cleaning the streets to building our Ram temple. His vision is just different.
But high unemployment and economic anxiety, driven by increasing cost of living, concern voters.
Economically, it's improved. They've launched rockets and all, which is good, but nothing for the middle class. Rich people have become richer, but we have to remain at the low level only.
26 parties have created an opposition alliance called the India Bloc to stop the BJP. But political commentator Mr. Ram says the opposition is already faltering.
It lacks in cohesion, with their constituents pulling each other in different directions.
Results will be called June 4th.
That's Meghna Bali. Over the coming years, the federal government will attempt a monumental rebuild of Australia's electricity system in a bid to reach its 82% renewable energy target by 2030. But an industry analyst is warning that in its ambition and haste, the government may also be risking the creation of so-called zombie projects that will never be built. Energy reporter Daniel Mercer explains.
Tristan Edis knows well the breathtaking pace of change underway in Australia's electricity system. He runs Green Energy Markets, an analysis firm specialising in the country's rapidly growing renewable energy industry. Thanks to that insight, he can see firsthand the queue of renewable energy projects waiting to be built.
There is an absolutely huge pipeline of projects, renewable energy projects in development. So we have tens and tens of thousands of megawatts of solar and wind projects in our development database.
Even still, Tristan Edis sees warning signs ahead for the federal government's flagship green energy policy, the so-called Capacity Investment Scheme unveiled in November. The scheme is aimed at ensuring Australia can generate 82% of its electricity from renewable sources by the end of the decade. It'll involve underwriting the cost of large-scale generation and storage projects, such as wind farms and batteries, and likely cost taxpayers billions. Tristan Edis says the scheme potentially faces a major problem. He reckons many of the projects that will bid for government support may not be ready for or worthy of it.
In those particular cases, government's being forced to make a prediction about the viability of a project perhaps several years in advance of it actually being operating. And what we've found with government tendering programs in the past is in many cases they end up supporting or selecting in their tender a range of projects that turn out to be zombies and they never happen.
To ward off such projects, he's calling for safeguards that include requiring developers to have planning and environmental approvals in place before they can bid for support. Simon Corbell is the chief executive of the Clean Energy Investor Group.
You do want to avoid the scenario where you have tyre kicking. Basically, proponents who are prepared to bid at very cheap rates but are not well prepared to actually deliver the project.
He's backing calls for stronger protections against inadequate bids.
There should also be provisions in place for governments to remove the award of contract terms in instances where projects do not meet appropriate timeframes in terms of achieving environmental and planning approvals.
A spokeswoman for Federal Climate Change and Energy Minister Chris Bowen said the capacity investment scheme had been carefully designed to deliver only the best projects. She said the huge competition and oversubscription from bidders for early tenders was proof the process was working. Tristan Edis from Green Energy Markets says the scale of the government's ambition should not be underestimated.
We've got to get 6,000 megawatts each and every year. And so we've got to get a lot more projects with planning approval. We don't have that sort of time.
That's Tristan Edis ending that report from Daniel Mercer. A wave of business insolvencies is sweeping through the nation's economy at a level not seen for more than a decade. ASIC expects more than 10,000 companies will enter administration by the end of this financial year as inflation dogs the economy. Some businesses are being squeezed between rising wages and costs and flattened consumer spending, and a growing number aren't coping. John Daly reports.
Behind each failed business is often an owner picking up the pieces. Wayne Owens ran his Perth-based commercial building company for 3 decades. It went into voluntary administration last year.
I'm still dealing with this on a daily basis, you know, the way it's impacted on my life. It's really hard to get up in the morning and be the happy person that I used to be, you know.
His business ran into big problems with fixed price contracts when building costs jumped almost 30% in recent years. Now in his 60s, Mr. Owens now has no super and few assets, and he's struggling to see a way forward.
You know, I'm sort of, at my age, concerned that, you know, yes, I'm probably going to be working until I drop, and two, I don't want to be out in the street trying to find somewhere to live, you know. So that's what I deal with on a daily basis, and it has been stressful.
The latest ASIC data shows more than 7,500 companies have entered administration in the first 3 quarters of this financial year, a 36% increase on the previous corresponding period last financial year. Building and construction firms are the worst affected, making up nearly 30% of businesses going under. That's followed by accommodation and food services, accounting for 15% of insolvencies this year. Suresh Manik is Chief Executive of the Restaurant and Catering Industry Association.
So on one side of the equation, in terms of all of the inputs, they are rising, and they're rising at a rapid and disproportional rate. On the other side of the equation, in terms of consumer spending and to some extent discretionary spend, we're finding that consumers are also finding it tough.
ASIC expects more than 10,000 businesses across the economy will have gone into administration by the end of this financial year, a level not seen since the 2012-2013 financial year. KPMG Chief Economist Brendan Rinn says this is a flow-on effect from COVID stimulus and more lenient insolvency laws during the pandemic.
Businesses that were struggling beforehand but tried as best as they could to keep going, but ultimately it's now caught up with them.
Brendan Rinn says this wave of insolvencies, as painful as it is a necessary post-pandemic correction.
So you'll often hear about zombie firms, where they're continuing to operate but are in fact pretty lifeless. They're not being able to invest, and they're really using labour and funds that could be used elsewhere more productively within the economy.
Another tough medicine to take in the current economy.
John Daly reporting, and that's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sally Sara.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. As the events unfolded at Bondi Junction last Saturday afternoon, an unsuspecting uni student was wrongly named as the killer on the social media platform X, formerly Twitter, and then on Channel 7. So how did the lie take off? Who was originally behind it? And how can we really hold social media giants to account for misinformed and dangerous content? Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.